Friday. Chapter 20. It was that boy. Galveston, Texas was blazing. It always was, but the end of June was brutal, especially up in Lizette Mercier's attic-cum-rehearsal studio. The AC in her rickety leased house refused to work, except randomly, on Sundays, Mondays, and Wednesdays. To combat the oppressive heat, Lizette scattered Home Depot fans around the periphery of the pink-painted attic, which caused papers, boas, gowns, bedazzled sashes, robes, and other sequined miscellanea to fly about as if caught in a windstorm. Lizette relished the drama. Sometimes she even threw confetti directly into the fan just to get her girls used to being distracted while performing. Something always threw you off on stage. Bright lights, a glimpse of your boyfriend, side eye from the judges. Your competition doing terrible things to ruin your stage presence, like when Emmeline Hargrove flashed that hairy nude Burt Reynolds centerfold from an old 70s Cosmo at her from the wings. When was that? 1983? No, 84. The Miss South Louisiana Mardi Gras pageant. Emmeline Hargrove was trash. Lizette got revenge, though. First by nailing the talent portion of the show, Brick House, on clarinet, and then by nailing Emmeline's dad, Justice Peter Hargrove. Lizette won Miss Congeniality that year. It wasn't the big prize, but she was pleased nonetheless. Sometimes smaller victories count more, she thought. That's quite the catchphrase, actually. I should get that printed on a banner for my girls. It was time to replace the banner draped across her black wall anyway. To thine own self be true. After winning Junior Miss Crawfish, one of Lizette's girls had crafted the glittery sign for her. It was a decade old and the sequence had fallen off of the E in thine. To thine own self be true didn't make sense. But she always encouraged her girls to remain as skinny as possible, so it still worked. Lizette wasn't sentimental, but she did love gifts from her students. Sweets, stuffed animals, bouquets. Her favorites were the thank you notes. She was the most successful pageant coach in the greater Galveston Beach area, which was a feat considering she ran a strictly word-of-mouth operation. No marketing. And definitely no social media. She loathed the thirstiness of Instagram, and Facebook felt like a yearbook from the Twilight Zone. To Lizette, all the conveniences that were supposed to make your life easier were actually just the tech equivalent of mosquitoes buzzing in your ears. She hated mosquitoes, and she hated being bothered. Plus, Lizette didn't want to be found. The internet wasn't a place for people with secrets. Her first client had been her neighbor's daughter, whom she'd spied practicing for Little Miss Forever Beautiful in their shared backyard. The perky fifth grader had been working on a majorette routine but kept dropping her baton. "You need a longer wand, darling," she'd called out over the peeling, ticky-tacky iron gate dividing their lawns. "One to match your wingspan." Lizette had continued with her unsolicited performance notes, and when Kaylee swept every title in the competition, she knew her advice had value. Right now, she was working with Mackenzie Foster, a twerking, tap-dancing, death-dropping demon. Lizette leaned forward in her director's chair, lasering in on the little girl's form. Lizette wasn't a trained dancer, but she did understand presence. When she worked as a cocktail waitress, the mere cadence of her walk inspired chaos. Or at least it inspired drunken, red-faced white men to shout, "Halle Berry!" at her. Lizette looked nothing like Halle. It was that white person phenomenon where they see a pretty brown face and declare that it looks like the first pretty brown face that springs to their minds. She'd been compared to Thelma from Good Times, Jasmine Guy from A Different World, and the black girl from Saved by the Bell who went nuts. No resemblance. Just another way they make you feel invisible, she thought. Lizette knew that the only person she looked like was herself, and Chloe Mercier. All told, her past didn't bother her. Nothing bothered her, really. She lived on a Xanax-assisted cloud, stubbornly impervious to bad feelings and dark days. When a depressive thought popped up, she swatted it away. "One more time, sweet Mackenzie," she purred, adjusting her kimono so it draped prettily around her legs. At 55, with dreamy doe eyes and hot-rollered hair rippling to her shoulders, she looked like she ran an upscale 1940s brothel, not a kiddie pageant consultancy. When Lizette first heard her Samsung Galaxy ring, she ignored it. The phone sat on the director's chair next to hers, the one she reserved for helicopter moms who wanted to observe rehearsals. After it rang a good 6 times, Lizette caught a glimpse of the name lighting up her screen. She yelped and then accidentally crushed her Diet Coke can in her right hand. "Holy shit," she said, grabbing the phone. "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay, Mackenzie, keep practicing, doll. I'm gonna step downstairs for a moment. Need to take a call." "Okay, Miss Lizette," panted Mackenzie, who'd been dancing for 40 minutes straight. Lizette floated downstairs. She looked in her wall mirror, added a bit more CoverGirl Red Revenge lipstick to her bee-stung lips, and then draped herself over her white leather-look couch. "Hello, Genevieve," she cooed, all honey-mellow tones and lilting accent. "Hey, Mom. Hi." Her daughter sounded frantic, and close as if she were yelling from the next room. It must have been an emergency if she was calling her on a random afternoon in June. They talked exactly 4 times a year, twice in April on each of their birthdays, once in September on Audrey's birthday, and at Christmas. She couldn't imagine what had precipitated the call, but to her daughter, everything was a crisis. Lizette had barely seen Genevieve since she'd moved away from home. When she came back from that psychiatric ward where the police sent her, she would never have had her flesh and blood committed, good God. Genevieve had told her in a long, teary midnight conversation that her therapists had said she needed space. From her mother. For her health. Space. Those were her words, in that kitchen, in their janky rented apartment in Washington, D.C. That home had never felt like one. Just an in-between purgatory riddled with bad luck. Everything fell apart in D.C. Genevieve went missing, Lizette's lover went missing too, and then, one night, he hobbled into his bar where she was cocktail waitressing. She yelped, seeing his chubby square frame propped up on crutches and his face bruised to hell and back. She sidled up to him, a vision in black lace. "My condolences to the other guy," she chirped breathily into his hairy ear, an attempt to appeal to his unearned vanity. But he didn't react at all. He just looked right through her. It wasn't a look, actually. It was an unlook. The end. It shouldn't have hurt so much. She'd been dumped before. But this one had such potential. Lizette had met him while waitressing in Vegas. Over Bloody Mary's, he'd invited her to live in D.C., promising to set her up nicely and teach her how to manage his bar. She'd hoped he'd be her forever guy. She was so tired of starting over with a new man every couple years, only to be abandoned for unspecified reasons. When bad things happened over and over, it was a sign. God was telling you to change your attitude, your hair, your address, something. So she knew why Genevieve had fled. Lizette also knew that no matter where or how far you went, you couldn't outrun yourself. But her daughter was grown. What could she do? She hugged her, kissed her, and helped her pack for the dorm. And space stretched across years. Until one night, Lizette picked up a glamour in the dressing room where she was dancing and saw a profile on Genevieve in the ones-to-watch section, and discover that she had a baby and an ex-husband, neither of whom she'd met. Lizette didn't lay eyes on Audrey till she was 2. It was cruel. She hadn't raised her daughter to have such ghastly manners, but in the end, maybe Genevieve had been right to sever ties. Genevieve was even now, and she and Audrey were both thriving. "Everything turns out the way it oughta," she thought. "What's wrong, bae?" She plucked a cigarette from the Parliament pack under her couch cushion and lit up. On an exhale, she said, "Must be trouble. Are you smoking?" Lizette took a deep drag and then blew smoke directly into the receiver. "No." "You said you'd quit. I sent you those e-cigs. Did you get them?"
"Jesus, Mary, Joseph."
"Jesus, Mary, Joseph.
Why are you tending to my business? Don't antagonize me. I'm in the middle of a class."
She glanced above where Mackenzie's rat-a-tat-tat-tat tapping pounded through the ceiling. "I need to ask you something. It's important."
"You sound off," said Lizette. "You been crying?"
"What happened the morning you found me in the Wisconsin Avenue house?" Slowly, as if moving through water, Lizette brought her fingers to the corner of her mouth. They'd never talked about this. Genevieve always insisted she didn't want to revisit that morning ever again. Long ago, she'd put her foot down.
"Why now?" "I don't like to think about that morning," she said. "I'm having a hard day, G. So many girls, so little time, and I'm exhausted. You should see little Mackenzie up there."
She gestured at the ceiling with her cigarette.
"No bigger than a minute, but she projects to the stars."
Upstairs, Mackenzie's tapping was actually shaking the ceiling. Lizette's crystal chandelier, a long ago gift for excellent services rendered, was swaying. That was probably dangerous. It could fall on her.
"Oh, well," she thought, her eyelids fluttering shut. "We all die of something."
"I need you to tell me every detail, Mom."
"Well, why you ain't asked till now? When you come back from that insane asylum."
"Insane asylum? It was Howard University Hospital's psychiatric ward. Not one flew over the cuckoo's nest."
"Well, whatever. You forbade me to ever discuss it again. You made me promise."
"I was a kid."
"Yes. A stubborn, hinky kid with volcanic emotions. I ain't want to upset you. So I did what you asked. Besides," she said haughtily, "there are things we just don't talk about. That's our relationship."
"We have a relationship?
Lord, the theatrics."
"Tell me," Genevieve demanded. "Please."
"Fine."
Lizette propped herself up on her silk pillows. With an indulgent yawn, she sank into a feline, full-body stretch, her kimono fluttering and rippling around her killer legs. Then she crossed her feet at the ankles and lit up her 11th cigarette of the day.
"Think. How?"
Lizette heard her daughter's voice crack a little.
"How what, Genevieve?"
"How did you get to the house?" she asked, in a flimsy, hesitant voice. And Lizette wasn't positive, but judging from the way she asked the question, it seemed that she already knew the answer. How she knew, Lizette had no idea, but her hunches were rarely wrong. A chill knifed through her. Lizette knew she was on trial, but she had no idea where this interrogation was coming from.
"I don't want to talk about this," she whined petulantly.
"I really don't care." What did she have to lose? Her daughter already hated her, and if God was judging her for her crimes, lying to her daughter to protect her would be the least of her sins.
"I'll try to remember," sighed Lizette. "I've been calling you all week, and you never answered. Imagine if Audrey ran away like that."
"She wouldn't," said Genevieve, with devastating finality. Lizette cleared her throat.
Finally, on Sunday morning, my phone rang, but it wasn't you."
"Who was it?"
"It was that boy."
"Shane?"
"Shane. Lizette rolled her eyes to the ceiling at the mention of his name, and then realized that she could no longer hear Mackenzie tapping upstairs. Unacceptable. She slipped off her violet stiletto and threw it at the ceiling, where it hit with a thud and then landed on an accent table in a tray of pink and yellow macaron. She eyed this pastel tableau from the couch. Looked like the cover of a 90s chick lit novel. Mom, are you there? Shane called you?
Yes, how many times I gotta say it?
Lizette held a pillow to her chest.
He was all distressed. Said you were in trouble and gave me the address. I drove there so fast I got a ticket. Got there and you weren't breathing. He was crying, saying it was all his fault, which it was, because there were drugs everywhere. Pills, liquor, just depravity, a razor, and you had terrible cuts. I knew he'd done it all. You were my innocent little baby.
Oh, Mom, she moaned. Jesus, you got it so wrong.
I called the paramedics, she said proudly, and then I called the police.
And then they called the Oriental girl whose daddy lived there. You can't say Oriental, she said flatly. So you called the police. It was you.
If I knew the cops would send you to the loony bin, I wouldn't have, but yes, I called the police. That boy kidnapped you, hurt you. You were bleeding. Any mother would have done the same. Imagine if it were Audrey. Besides, he knew he was guilty. You can't imagine. He wouldn't let you go. He was holding both of your hands in his, just wouldn't let go. Then he crawled in bed and held you right in front of me, so disrespectful. Imagine if it was your baby. He refused to move. When the cops got there, it took all three of them to drag him away from you.
Lizette hadn't thought about this in years, but the memory still infuriated her.
How dare that boy, who was clearly to blame, be so upset? She was the mother. She got to be upset.
Lizette's world was falling apart. Her boyfriend had just dumped her, and here was this kid so consumed by love for her daughter that he had to be physically dragged away. Genevieve was a child. She hadn't even lived yet. Why did she get that kind of adoration when Lizette had never experienced it? It wasn't the order of things. It wasn't fair.
What happened then? Genevieve asked in a broken whisper. I had him arrested and put away. Good fucking riddance. I believe he went to juvenile detention. They told me it was his third time, serial predator.
Silence.
You're welcome, said Lizette, nervousness creeping through her.
Nothing.
Hello?
All these years. Genevieve's voice sounded reedy. All these years I thought he was a coward. A liar. I hated him.
Well, who's to hate if it ain't him?
Her daughter had no response to this, apparently. Her silence was so complete, so lengthy, that for a moment, Lizette thought she'd hung up.
You never noticed that I cut myself? She asked hesitantly. You must have known. What? You were so secretive. How would I know that?
I know when Audrey gets a paper cut.
Well?
Lizette took a deep drag. You need to get you a life, bae.
I cut myself. He didn't do it. And I'd been taking drugs. Your drugs, or getting them from your boyfriends my whole life. I wasn't your innocent little baby.
How'd you get them from my boyfriends?
Lizette's voice went cold, sharp. She hated being reminded of her failed loves and how hard her life had been, and that she was never able to fix what hurt her daughter. But Genevieve had always felt so unreachable. Her pain took her to a place where no one could follow.
I've been watching you my whole life, Mom. Careful, your tone. I was in agony. I needed help. I know you suffer, my babe. But what could I do? I prayed for you. I still pray for you. But you can't fight a curse. I've been telling you to get some houseplants.
The force of Genevieve's long-suffering exhale carried across 9 states.
My girls always ask me why I got so many dead plants. I tell them what Mama Chloe told me. Deceased plants are good luck. When a houseplant dies, it's because it's absorbed bad energy and juju. Bad juju meant for you, their protection.
After dropping this gem, she took a deep drag off her cigarette.
Everybody's got an affliction, Genevieve. Whether it's mental or physical or spiritual, you just gotta remember what good you got.
Please, don't get philosophical, Mom. It doesn't look good on you.
Everything looks good on me except dolman sleeves, she said testily. Look, I don't know what's got you ornery or why we're discussing ancient history, but a word of advice? Get over your childhood. I got over mine. You think you had it bad? I had to perform unspeakable acts for pageant judges just so I could win a little money to buy groceries and fake Jordache jeans from Family Dollar.
Genevieve's silence was deafening.
They were called Gordache jeans, said Lizette sadly.
You sent Shane away.
Genevieve sounded like she was speaking more to herself than to Lizette.
He was terrified of going to prison again. I told him that I'd make sure he never went back.
Oh, gee, Lizette cooed. That boy preyed on you. That's what they all do. They want the pretty girl, but then get jealous of your youth and vitality, so they lure you down the path to ruin and break you.
Jealous of youth? Shane and I were the same age.
Well, I know, but I was talking about me.
Lizette smoothed her kimono over her legs, exasperated. After another extended silence, Genevieve finally spoke.
You were jealous.
I've never been jealous in my life, but I'll tell you what. Mercier women are cursed. We are. And if I can't make a man stay, there's no way in hell you could.
Lizette tightened the sash on her kimono.
I don't know why you're so determined to hate me. You get got by a cute little criminal, I rescue you, and I'm the villain. How's that work?
You really want me to explain this?
Go ahead and judge me, miss. I fear nothing but the pitiless gaze of the Almighty. You could be Mommy Dearest or Claire Huxtable, don't matter what kind of mother you are. Daughters always blame moms for every mess they make.
Lizette took one last drag and then stubbed her cigarette out in a crystal ashtray. Under her breath, she said,
In 15 years, Audrey'll give her therapist an earful.
You don't understand one thing that's happened to you. Do you?
Genevieve asked wearily.
Stop being so morose, G. We had some really fun times when you were little. Remember those adorable lovebirds?
They died of lead poisoning.
And that's my fault?
They died of lead poisoning because when they chirped at night, you throw pencils at their cage.
Well, who knew pencils were edible? Did you?
Goodbye, Mom.
Stop being so mad at me. You know, boys like Shane belong behind bars.
Lizette was grasping at straws now, just trying to keep Genevieve on the phone. Genevieve had always confused her. When you're pregnant, you think you're going to have a little you, a tiny person with your same thoughts, same feelings, but her daughter came out wholly herself. Self-sufficient, stubborn, too clever for the world, and an utter mystery. Lizette never really knew how to raise her, and Lord knows, Genevieve never gave any clues.
I saved you from a world of trouble. Look at who you've become. You're...
Lizette stopped talking then because her line went dead. Well, wasn't the first time her daughter had hung up on her, and it wouldn't be the last. She dragged herself off the couch and swept back upstairs to Mackenzie. One out of dozens of girls whom Lizette had made perfect in her image. With each new student, Lizette had a chance to get it right.
season after season, show after show, again and again. Chapter 21. What a coincidence. Eva was way too frugal to have a habit of Ubering. Besides, she lived right by the Q train. But tonight, she didn't care. She didn't care about anything except getting to Shane. Cece had agreed to watch Audrey for the night. She was only too happy to spend the night with her favorite faux niece, but on one condition. Eva had to vow to attend her party tomorrow. You know, just an insidery get-together to celebrate the Liddy Awards. With a rushed, anything you want, of course, yes, I'll be there. Eva agreed and zipped out the door. Eva was barely cognizant of what she was agreeing to. She had only one thought in her brain. I need him, she thought while ordering a $37 Uber. Need him, she thought while racing over the Manhattan Bridge and through downtown. Need, she thought while flying up the stairs at 81 Horatio Street. It was 9:45 on a warm, weirdly windy Friday night, far from yesterday's glaring heat and her fight with Shane. Horatio was quiet, but she could hear the distant revelry of rich recent grads cocktailing and carousing at the outdoor beer garden on Washington. But here, in front of James Baldwin's ostentatious peacock blue door, the darkness was so complete she felt like it might swallow her whole. Heart thundering in her chest, she leaned against the door's smooth surface, forehead first, palms flat. She allowed herself a few deep, cleansing breaths, just to dull the thudding in her head, which had been threatening to explode since she'd hung up on Lizette. And then for the second time in 2 days, Eva knocked on this door. But this time she pounded, and Shane opened it right away. She could barely see beyond him. There wasn't a light on in the house, just darkness upon darkness, but she saw him, breathtaking in front of her. Tall, strong, solid. Hers. Eva met his eyes and something jolted inside her. I know everything, she said, wanting to sound pulled together, but the hitch in her voice betrayed her. Come in. She didn't budge. She had to say what she'd come here to say, and it spilled out of her like a flood. My mom told me. And you were young and scared and trying to be tough, and I promised you that you'd never go back. I promised. And she sent you back. She gulped dryly. Shane, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for everything I said yesterday. I'm sorry for blaming you all these years, for hating you. I hated you so much. I know, he said hoarsely. Just come inside. No, listen. I hated you only because... Eva paused. It was because loving you wasn't an option. Shane averted his eyes, his jaw clenched. Why didn't you tell me? She asked. Why? I couldn't, he said. He looked years younger, vulnerable. There's so much I need to know. Later. But... Shane grabbed her by the front of her dress and pulled her inside the shadowy foyer. He slammed the door and pressed her back against it. The only light came from the moon dimly shining through the open bay windows across the apartment. Disoriented, Eva blinked. She was acutely aware of everything, his scent, his rugged scruff, his crumpled tee, the line of his biceps, his eyes. Shane overwhelmed her. She was dizzy with him. With a groan, Shane smashed his mouth against hers, kissing her into the door. He tangled his hand in her curls, pulling her head back to deepen the kiss. Over and over they savored each other, their kisses hot and hungry. Fuck, he said. You're here.
I'm here.
Mouth open on her neck, he slipped his hand beneath her short, gauzy slip dress and slid it up her inner thigh. Possessively, he squeezed the soft skin there. She went liquid. Tell me what you want, Shane rasped into her ear.
She wanted him all over her, his scent, his mouth, his tongue, his hands, him. She wanted him to mark her so she'd never remember anyone else. Just want you. Everywhere. Shane grabbed her hand and dragged her through the darkness to the bedroom. The wind picked up again, rattling the massive windows and howling against the building. Between broken kisses, they stumbled blindly into the moon-dappled bedroom. There was a rumpled rainy-day sexiness to the bed. A poofy duvet collapsed in Shane-shaped dents. They dropped onto it together, a tangle of limbs, pillows toppling to the floor. Grabbing her jaw between his fingers, Shane drew Eva into a quick, filthy kiss. And then, without warning, he flipped her around. Starting at her ankle, he ran his mouth up along the back of her calf, scratching her with his stubble, leaving a searing kiss behind her knee. She moaned, grabbing the sheets in her fists, but he kept going, planting a wet love bite just under her butt cheek, and then slowly dragging his tongue up along her spine. Ravenous, Shane pushed her sweaty curls aside and sucked Eva's neck. "Turn around," he directed lustily. Without thought, she did. Inching his way down her body, he slipped his hands under her ass, pulled her to his mouth, and went for it. No teasing, no buildup. The shock was delicious. She cried out, arched her back, and then he stopped. With a teasing smirk, he climbed up her body. "Hi," he grinned. "Why'd you stop?" "Needed to kiss you," he did, chastely on her mouth. "You're the worst. Fuck me, please. Fuck me on James Baldwin's bed." Shane laughed. "This isn't James Baldwin's bed. You think they had Sleep Number beds in 1961? "Oh," she grabbed at his arms. "Well, then fuck me on this Sleep Number bed. Come first. Then I'll fuck you." Before she could think, he was avidly tonguing her again, and she was coming apart. "Eva." "What?" she whimpered, riding wave after wave. "Eva, what? Look at me." She peered down at Shane's face, his wicked mouth on her. Oh, it was an obscene, exquisite sight. Once her eyes locked with his, Shane sank two fingers deep inside her. Gently he hooked them in a come-hither motion, and that was it. She came, riding out every jolt. The spike of her orgasm subsided, but her high didn't. Despite Shane reducing her to jello, Eva managed to climb on top of him. Gripping him, she carefully eased herself down. With a throaty groan, he grabbed her ass in one hand, her breast in the other, and gave up control. "Go ahead," he rasped, catching his bottom lip in his teeth. "Take what's yours." Eva did. Grinding against him, winding her hips. Their breathing went choppy, their eyes squeezed shut. He moaned her name. She went incoherent. He squeezed her tighter, and finally, the electricity sent them both over the edge. Dazed, Shane sat up, pulling Eva toward him, wrapping his arms around her. Eva crossed her legs behind his back, and they held each other there for who knows how long. At some point, they toppled onto the bed together, still attached. Hadn't they always been? Later, she sat with Shane on the terrace floor, overlooking a hidden garden in the backyard. The night had turned cool, so they were wrapped in an oversized beach blanket. "This week," she started, "is it history repeating itself?"
"History doesn't repeat itself," said Shane. "But it rhymes."
"Who said that, Nas?"
"Mark Twain."
"Hmm," she said. "Great philosophers, both." A few hours after that, they were lying horizontally across the bed. The wind had picked up again, rattling the windows. Come hazy after a drowsy fuck.
They were tangled up together in the dark, her back sealed to his chest, his face buried in her hair. And finally, he told her what had happened that last morning in D.C.
"You didn't wake up," Shane said in a solemn voice. "I couldn't bring myself to slap you like in the movies, but I shook you hard, and nothing happened. You were dying, and it was my fault. I'd given you all those drugs."
Eva pulled his hand from her breast up to her mouth and kissed it. She tucked it under her chin.
"I held you for a long time, just, you know, crying and trying to figure out what to do. Then I remembered your phone down in the kitchen. When I got it, I saw like 30 missed calls from your mom. So I called her. And I knew how it'd look when she got there. I broke into that house. I brought you there. I had prior arrests. And over the previous 8 hours, I'd emptied a bottle of vodka and snorted an indeterminate amount of heroin. So yeah, I knew it'd be bad for me."
"Why didn't you leave?" asked Eva.
"You could have called her, hidden somewhere, and then found me later."
"I couldn't leave you," he said with finality. "And I couldn't deny it when your mom accused me of hurting you." He paused. "I was almost 18, so I was tried as an adult. But I was only locked up for 2 years. Good behavior."
"You?"
"Yeah. I was different than before. I kept my head down, didn't start shit. Remember that mantra you gave me?"
"Yeah. Don't fight, right?"
"It kept me safe. And I wrote 8 there."
Eva turned to face him.
"I'm so sorry."
"No, I'm sorry. That's what I came to New York to say. I'm sorry I broke my promise. And I'm sorry I didn't find you the second I was released. But by then you'd published your first book. You were a success. I didn't want to ruin it. Back then I was convinced that I ruined everything I touched."
Eva looked at him, remembering what he'd revealed to her long ago, losing his stable, happy life with his foster parents. Blaming himself.
"After I accidentally broke my arm, and my foster mom..." He paused, jaw working. "When I survived the crash on the way to the hospital and my foster mom didn't, I started breaking my arm on purpose, drinking all day, and I decided that I didn't deserve good things."
Eva held him tight. It was all she could do. Hold him tight enough to smother that thought for good. Later, Shane and Eva lay in a tangle on the plush living room rug, staring up at the stained glass window on the ceiling. Shane was on his side, tracing the planes of her face with his fingertips. Across her eyebrow, down the bridge of her nose. Cradling her face in his palms, he smooshed her cheeks together so her lips poked out. Then he stuck his finger in her dimple.
"Just say it," Eva said with a smile.
"I've never said it to anyone."
"It won't hurt, I promise."
Shane grinned, a heart-stopping thing, then laid his face on her breasts, closing his eyes.
"Ready?" he asked.
"Ready."
"I love you," said Shane. "Dramatically, violently, and forever."
She kissed the top of his head, smiling brighter than the sun.
"I've always loved you," he whispered.
"What a coincidence," she whispered back. "I've always loved you, too."
Some indeterminate time later, Eva and Shane were eating mint gelato out of the jar in the brightly tiled kitchen. She was perched on the island. They were each wearing a pair of Shane's boxer briefs. And nothing else.
"And I can't make this movie with white characters. I couldn't live with myself," she said. "But I don't know what to do. I can't even finish book 15.
"Isn't it due next week?"
"I've been distracted," she smiled, licking gelato off her spoon.
"I'm out," he said, pretending to walk away. I can't be responsible for the downfall of your career.
Stop, you're not,
she said, grabbing him by the waistband. Honestly, I just can't find the spark anymore. And all I want to do is write my family's story. Go to Louisiana, like we said, research those women and write.
Do you realize how valuable you are?
Please, she scoffed, scooping up more gelato.
To the literary community?
To me.
She looked at him. Come with me to Bellefleur, she blurted out. Audrey flies to her dad's for 3 months tomorrow. You don't start teaching till late August. We have time.
Let's go, he said with a grin. I'll be your research assistant, among other things.
Yeah?
Lasciviously, Eva licked a dollop of gelato from her bottom lip.
What else do you want to be?
Shane watched her. Then he plucked her off the island and turned her around so her back was against him. He slipped his hand under the elastic of her boxer briefs and slowly massaged her clit. Her head fell back against his shoulder.
I want to be everything, he said, his mouth against her ear. I want to be the reason you light up. I want to make you laugh, make you moan, make you safe.
He kept stroking her as she quivered helplessly.
I want to be the thought that lulls you to sleep, the memory that gets you off. I want to be where all your paths end.
He nipped her earlobe.
I want to do everything you do to me.
He pulsed his finger then, and she came with a shuddery cry.
You're hired, she breathed.
Finally, Eva dozed off in Shane's arms just before dusk. They were on the couch, or perhaps the bed again. Later, she'd remember mumbling,
You know you're the turtle, right? The one who comes and goes as he pleases while I wait for you.
She never heard his answer, because she slipped off into sleep. Deep, contented, trusting.
Saturday. Chapter 22. Word traveled fast. Happy Saturday, gorgeous people. You're cordially invited to my abode today at 1 p.m. Bring nothing but your dazzling personalities and most scandalous industry gossip. As usual, this is a private affair, no phones, but since this is a day party, parents feel free to bring your kiddos. I'm designating the downstairs guest bedroom a kiddie wonderland, catered by Dylan's Candy Bar and Shake Shack. One thing, I do adore your children, but please discourage them from touching the chintz chinoiserie tea in the lounge. It was a wedding gift from my husband's godmother, Diane Carroll. See you shortly. Exactly none of the invited authors, visual artists, web whizzes, filmmakers, and fashion designers on CC's list were surprised that the invite came a mere 8 hours before the party started. That was her tradition, and it kept everyone on their toes. Stay ready so you don't have to get ready, was one of her many mottos. Her penthouse was littered with modern art, sharp corners, and priceless objets d'art, but it was also a true indoor-outdoor space, with a massive terrace overrun with greenery and bathroom windows looking out onto the lower Manhattan skyline. Cece had worked hard with interior designer Lee Mendel to make the space function as no more than a chic backdrop. So when she entertained, the people were the decoration. In that setting, each of her guests turned into a star. They stood out as unique, special, colorful characters. Oh. And they were characters. Milling about were some of artsy Black Manhattan's loudest personalities. There was Janie, the story-topping memoirist. Craig, the rascally gallerist. Tilly, the giggly graphic novelist. Keisha, the proudly basic jewelry designer. Rashid, the intolerably fine book agent. Cleo, the fashion photographer obsessed with her blessings. Lenny, the film editor who pledged Q at Duke and needs you to know it. Everyone was there. The sun shone bright and warm through Cece's windows. Champagne was flowing. Beautiful waiters served bacon-wrapped asparagus, tiny crab toasts, and parmesan tuiles. Vegans were offered petite litella glass cubes filled with fresh-cut fruit. A DJ hidden in the kitchen played chill but fun tracks a la Solange, Khalid, and SZA. Some guests were kikiing on the terrace. Many were strewn across the couches. And the parents were truly kicking up their heels because their little Chloes and Jadens were downstairs in their finest Zara kids ensembles, blessedly out of sight and taken care of. Eva wore her favorite summertime sexy look, a black romper with a strapless bustier top. It made her legs look endless and her boobs luscious. She'd swept her curls to the side with a vintage pin and added smoky eyes. She was in full siren mode. She was also loopy as hell after a night of no sleep and endless orgasms. Neither her brain nor her legs were working properly, and she kept dissolving into embarrassing secret giggles. Eva loved Shane, and he loved her. Nothing else mattered. Certainly not what anyone else thought. But earlier, they'd tried to make a plan for how to approach the day. Today, 10:28 a.m. Shane, you going to CC's? Eva, I have to. She tricked me. Shane, then I'm going too. I fucking miss you. Eva, you saw me this morning. Shane, I'm in withdrawal. Eva, same, times 1,000. Shane, how do we act in public? Eva, normal, exclamation mark. Shane, but what's our normal? Naked? Eva, good point. This is weird. Shane, we'll figure it out. Eva, you know she threw this party to get the tea on us, right? Shane, fucking Cece. You gonna tell her? Eva, I won't have to. She'll know. And Cece did know. The second she laid eyes on Eva, she was dripping with sex. It was obvious. Eva couldn't remember the last time she'd felt so light, so unguarded. Shane had fucked away all her defenses, and now she was a mushball, giddy, aglow, swooning from happiness in plain view of 45 gossipy blacks. But she didn't care. Around 3:30 a.m. after the gelatogasm, she'd had an epiphany. Something had been unlocked in her. For so long and in so many ways, Eva had been holding herself back. Now she wanted to figure out who she was and then be her, delight in her, delight in everything, have an actual life and live it. She vowed to herself to be honest with herself and with everyone. In pain, admit it. In love, claim it. Life was too short to be anything but herself. Listen to me, she thought. I get one slice of dick and turn into a wide-eyed Disney princess. She didn't realize that she'd laughed out loud until Belinda and Cece looked at her with eyebrows raised. They were struggling to maintain a conversation with Belinda's latest service industry boy toy. She'd traded in her Trader Joe's dude for Kane, a copper-skinned snack she'd hired from TaskRabbit to build her IKEA dresser. Kane was 24, stocky, sexy, and he spoke only in one-word responses. So, started Cece, resplendent in a fitted fuchsia pantsuit and white teddy. It's a fun party, right? Vibes, Kane said, nodding. Kane, that's such a cool name, said Eva. Is it biblical? Fox, he said. Do you have a brother named Abel? Eva giggled at her own joke. I bet you hear that all the time. Word, said Kane. You know, I've never met a Kane or an Abel, mused Cece. The Weeknd's real name is Abel, said Belinda. Is your brother the Weeknd? Eva asked Kane. If so, I have some notes about his hair. Clownin', said Kane, chuckling. Belinda quickly steered the conversation toward something he could talk about.
Babe, she said, tell them about your blossoming DJ business.
That she'd fire, said Kane.
With that, he'd officially worn out his welcome.
Babe, go get me another Aperol spritz.
Belinda, who was slaying in a cropped white halter top, a floral maxi skirt, and long box braids, patted Kane's ass and sent him on his way.
Wow, said Eva, stifling a giggle.
Okay, but did you see how fine he is?
Whispered Belinda.
And he's just level one of my summertime thought journey.
As if on cue, the DJ spun a Travis Scott track into Hot Girl Summer. The crowd let out a collective, "Ay!" and champagne glasses went up. These partygoers hadn't been the cool kids growing up. They'd spent their adolescence buried in art books, scrawling poems into steno pads during recess, living full stories in their heads. Distracted by their artistic micro-obsessions, many forgot to learn how to engage with the world. They were too busy studying life, storing up their notes to use later in a novel, a song, a script, a painting. They were observers, not joiners. As adults, they made up for lost time. They were now a bunch of celebrated, critically acclaimed 30-something artists who behaved like 10th graders. They gossiped like crazy, made out at house parties, and made awkward, drunken decisions. Exhibit A, across the room. Khalil, the inescapable mansplainer from the Brooklyn Museum panel, was dry-humping a potted plant. Cece grabbed her husband, Ken, by the arm. He was mid-conversation with a famed art world titan. Honey, see that man over there dressed like Carlton Banks? Please cut him off. Ken, who appeared to be completely asleep behind his pleasant expression, kissed the titan on the cheek and hurried off.
Children are downstairs, huffed Cece. What's wrong with Khalil?
Belinda snorted.
How much time you got?
Actually, not much, because I have to make the hostess rounds, said Cece. So while I'm here, madam, she pointed her martini glass at Eva, I suggest you explain that luminous glow. Did I really need to orchestrate a whole ass party to get an explanation?
Eva bit her lip and shrugged.
I will not stand for this mysterious shit, said Belinda. Stop being such a Scorpio with an Aries moon. What happened this week? You go missing for days and then show up here looking like you got hit by the dick truck.
Who got hit by the dick truck?
Asked a famed bookfluencer with 2 million Instagram followers and an ear for gossip. She was shimmying by on her way to pluck shrimp off a tray.
She said, dump truck, corrected Cece smoothly. I know the music is so loud.
The bookfluencer grimaced, offered her apologies, and floated off. Eva crowded the girls closer to her. Audrey was tucked away downstairs with a gaggle of toddlers watching Paw Patrol. This was a safe space.
My plan was to ignore Shane, she whispered. But we had a day together, and it was fun. Really fun.
He met Audrey.
She gestured for Belinda and Cece to move in closer.
We had sex all over James Baldwin's house last night.
Her friends gawked at her.
Where? Asked Cece. Nicely done, Belinda approved.
I've always wanted to get naked and rub myself all over Langston Hughes' abode in Harlem, you know, to manifest his gifts.
No, 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 said Eva. Shane's renting James Baldwin's place for the week.
That's lovely, said Cece. Two successful authors reuniting, having their first adult sex together while surrounded by the spirit of a literary legend.
Eva took a sip of her seltzer.
Well, it wasn't the first time. That was 3 days ago, at a downtown art installation.
The hell y'all doing out here, said Belinda, pouting and jealous. I'm supposed to be the kinky one.
It sounds crazy, but the whole thing feels so natural. As kids, we were too raw. We just weren't ready for each other. Now we are.
Cece radiated satisfaction. Eva had admitted to a relationship with Shane at her party. The exorbitant price tag was worth it.
So, do you really think you can pick up where you left off after 15 years? Eva didn't answer her because she'd stopped listening. Instead, she was beaming in the direction of the front door. There was Shane, exasperatingly handsome, in a dark tee, dark jeans, and 3-day stubble, and gazing at Eva like she hung the goddamn moon. Eva smiled even wider, if it were even possible. And then, flashing the smirk of the century, Shane stuck his finger into his cheek in the exact spot where Eva's dimple was flashing at him across the room. Eva winked at him, shooting him finger guns. Belinda fell out laughing. Y'all are the corniest dorks. I'm in violent support of this. Look at everyone's faces, gasped Cece, delighted by the revelers' breathless reaction to having a mysterious author within their midst. A members-only party wasn't a party without a surprise guest. Thrusting her drink into Belinda's free hand, Cece rushed off to greet her famed protégé. She wasn't the only one. It took only a few minutes for Shane to become swarmed by fawning peers. Between sweet glances her way, she could read on his face that he was uncomfortable. He was trapped, forced to be social when he just wanted to be with her. It was all Eva wanted, too. She was seconds away from taking a flying leap into his arms. Instead, she stood there, radiating big love energy in Shane's direction. And slowly, one by one, the partygoers picked up on it. Word traveled fast. Overheard near the terrace, "Wow, I've never seen Shane Hall smile," said a busty memoirist.
"I've never seen Shane Hall, period," remarked a bespectacled New Yorker essayist.
"Who's he making eyes at? Eva Mercy?"
"They're dating," said the essayist. "I saw fan pics yesterday, Black Book Twitter."
"Stop," exclaimed an agent. "I always assumed she was a super femme lesbian. Aren't vampires a lesbian thing?"
"Ooh, she does have that Zoe Kravitz energy."
"Zoe Kravitz isn't a lesbian."
"Neither is Eva Mercy, apparently. She's looking at Shane like he's a sizzling steak fajita."
Overheard near the bar,
"I fucked Shane Hall at Book Expo America in 2007, whispered a gazelle-like novelist. "He was so sweet."
"Then it wasn't him, girl," said her agent. Overheard near the cheese smorgasbord, "Ava's hella chill," said a sneaker designer who spoke in a 90s slam poetry voice. "It doesn't sit well with my spirit, her falling for the dangerous type." "He's fine as fuck, though," said an Alvin Ailey choreographer with a multicolored manicure. "Name me a fine man who isn't problematic." "True, pretty women are normal, but pretty men are nightmares."
"On the low low," started the designer. "Ever since I started dating unattractive men, I've been thriving."
Where do you find them?"
"Atlantic Center on a weeknight between the DMV, Applebee's, and Home Depot. Bitch, you leave with a mane and a side."
Overheard on the couch,
"I can't believe Shane Hall's here. He's so intimidating," whispered a wide-eyed young author who'd just dropped a smash debut novel, A Sing of Rainbow Children.
"We're just as talented," lied her friend, a celeb ghostwriter. "And we're not hot messes.
Somebody said he's sober now."
"I don't believe it. I was at a garden party at the 2010 Frankfurt Book Fair, and I saw this man sniff a rose bush, accidentally inhale a bee, punch himself in the nose, and knock himself out."
"You a whole liar."
"On God, I was like, how'd this wreck write 8?
"It happens. Look at Mariah. She can't walk across a stage without assistance from 16 Puerto Rican male dancers, but she's the voice of a generation."
Overheard near the bookcase,
"Khalil, why are you wearing a green shirt with pink pants?"
asked his ex, a snarky screenwriter.
"You an AKA, a tube of Maybelline Great Lash?"
"How dare you? You're wearing a wide-brimmed straw hat with a lace blouse. You look like Ida B. Wells."
"You gon' respect my great migration realness."
"Somebody told me Eva's dating Shane,"
grumbled Khalil. You think it's true?
Why him? Jerk off.
I'd like to jerk him off, she muttered. They must be dating. Look at how close they're standing. Damn, Eva's glowing. That skin.
Yeah, Khalil reluctantly agreed. She has the complexion of a wealthy infant.
And I heard she just got hit by a dump truck, she whispered in awe.
Meanwhile, by Cece and Ken's Kehinde Wiley portrait, Shane, after doing the social equivalent of rowing across the Atlantic, was finally standing in front of her. They gazed goofily at each other, the air crackling between them.
Hi, baby, said Shane.
Eva's stomach dropped. She wasn't ready for baby.
Hi,
she cooed. Stuffing his hands in his pockets, Shane leaned toward her and said,
Everybody's talking about us.
Eva took a cursory glance around the room.
And now, is it weird? Do you care?
He absentmindedly tapped his bottom lip, his expression rascally.
Not in the least.
With that, Shane wrapped an arm around her shoulders and kissed her temple. Preening, she linked her hand in his. They slotted together perfectly like two puzzle pieces. Cece's gasp was heard round the world. Et voila, the black book world's new prom king and queen were crowned. She'd gotten her moment. She almost burst into applause. Downstairs, Audrey was bored. She was stuck in a big AC frigid bedroom with eight children, all of whom were under 6 years old. They were watching the Lego movie as if it were actually compelling, as if it were something good, like Midsummer. Audrey couldn't relate to small children, not even when she was one. Plus, a casual study of the demo showed that they all had mental illness. Audrey had already diagnosed a handful of kids with OCD, ADD, and attachment disorder. The worst was a five-year-old named Otis. Total menace. Dressed like a tiny rapper in skinny jeans and Jordans, he had put a trash bin up on the dresser and was repeatedly dunking with a kiddie basketball. After every couple of dunks, he'd bust out in an aggressive Millie Rock. And then he'd moon the room.
If these little psychos are inheriting the world, thought Audrey, the future does not look promising.
The au pair, Lumusi, had fallen asleep in an uncomfortable-looking accent chair 20 minutes ago, leaving Audrey effectively in charge of this preschool.
Brood.
She hadn't come to this party to be an unpaid babysitter. In fact, she'd been under the impression that she'd get to be a real party guest, sipping mocktails on Auntie Cece and Uncle Ken's terrace while chatting with the cultural elite about politics, art, and world events. Auntie Cece's penthouse was Audrey's second home. She shouldn't have to stay hidden downstairs. She could hear the twinkly, forbidden sounds of grown-up mirth and merriment coming from upstairs, and she'd never experienced such FOMO. She huffed as Otis ran around in circles bare-assed. She refused to waste her brain cells and an adorable outfit, a Free People knit mini dress, on this upscale gymboree.
I'm out of here, Audrey thought, and headed upstairs.